With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom? Let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send her a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you wish to ask. And then she can either type a response or use their voice-to-text feature, and MyLifeInABook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and stories for eternity. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy. It's something that you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. And this is something that Ethan and I had been thinking about doing with our parents. We have this podcasting equipment, so we wanted to find a way for them to tell their story. But I love this because it's so regimented. They send them a question every week, and it just makes it really easy and turnkey. And it just seems like a great way for us to get our parents' stories down so that our children and our children's children can have them. So if you're interested, check out MyLifeInABook.com and use code ATTWG at checkout for 15% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use code ATTWG for 15% off today. Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges, from sleepless nights to stress-filled days. Mood.com has created an entire line of functional gummies that target specific health concerns with 100% federally legal THC blends that they'll deliver discreetly right to your doorstep. And you can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code ATTWG. It is wild how different each one of their gummies feels. Their sleepy time gummies knock me out in about 15 minutes flat with no hangovers, no grogginess, and I just wake up feeling amazing. Oh, and the Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for those days when nothing's going right and you just need to hit the reset button on your crap mood. What makes these different is how they pair THC and other cannabinoids with herbs and adaptogens. You're not gonna just find gummies like this in a dispensary, or anywhere for that matter. And they have gummies for literally everything. Immune support, menopause relief, PMS symptoms, mental clarity, and sexual arousal. And each one is crafted using federally legal cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no BS, and they can ship to most states in the U.S. Best of all, not only does Mood stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code ATTWG. So head to Mood.com, browse their amazing selection of functional gummies, and find the perfect gummy for whatever you're dealing with. And remember to use promo code ATTWG at checkout to save 20% on your first order. Remember when I talked about True Diagnostics True Age Test? Well, I took it myself and the results blew my mind. I was very wrong. If you remember, I was worried about my brain and not my cardiovascular health. And it turns out, my brain's fine, but my cardiovascular health needs work. But luckily, my biological age was really right on track with my actual age, which is good because research shows that if your biological age is even just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease can jump by as much as 30 to 50%. That's a big deal, and it's completely avoidable. The good news is nearly 90% of biological aging is in your hands. It's driven by things like your lifestyle, your habits, and the environment you're in, which means that you have a lot of control over it. The TrueAge test didn't just give me a number. It showed how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging, and it was eye-opening. And I will say, I definitely picked up the workouts after I learned that my cardiovascular health isn't as good as I thought it was. The test itself was super easy and convenient. I did it from home, and it was just a quick, painless finger prick that I made Ethan do because I was too scared. You send it off in a tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report about your aging and health. So if you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code ATTWG to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use ATTWG at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. On February 3rd, 1983, a young mother was brutally attacked by a stranger in her own home. Her three young sons were asleep in their beds, but her middle child, Mitchell, heard noises and came to check on his mother. Aura Owen screamed at Mitchell to run away, and then everything went black. Aura awoke 2 days later in the hospital, only to find out that Mitchell was gone. Despite what was clearly a forcible abduction, and despite the fact that Mitchell was only 4 years old, Menlo Park police took 3 days to begin an investigation into Mitchell's disappearance and initially classified him as a runaway. Nearly 40 years later, Aura is still trying to get justice for her son. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Mitchell Owens. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Thank you for joining us once again. Yes, I hope you're ready to get angry because, yeah, this story's nuts.
Yeah, I'm already angry.
Like, yeah.
What the
Yeah, no, I know. I actually forgot as I was writing the script that I wrote that I like revealed that in the intro that the police initially said he was a runaway, a four-year-old runaway.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
He'll come back.
Right?
He's four.
Yeah.
He probably has a Swiss Army knife on him.
He just witnessed
his mom get brutally beaten.
I mean, absolutely unbelievable. And, you know, so February 2023, we're recording this in July of 2022, it'll mark the 40th anniversary of Aura's horrific attack and her son's kidnapping. And there is very little public information on this case.
Excuse me. Her 4-year-old's runaway.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. I wasn't even able to find any like recent news or updates or anything on this. I mean, literally nothing within the last like 20 years. So I actually called the Menlo Park Police Department the other day just to see if I could find out what the status was, to see if, you know, because as we've learned from some of these cases, sometimes the police departments will be like, meh.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of get like, this sense from the get-go is just like, meh.
Yeah. And so
we'll see.
Yeah. And I called when I had only started to do the research on this case. I only know like kind of I only knew the overview, right? And I had gotten the impression that there was possibly evidence that could still be looked into, which I obviously don't want to get into right now. But I just wanted to see if like anybody was doing anything, if this case was even open. So I did get in touch with somebody, and according to them, both the assault and the abduction are under the same case number. So both are technically open. So, like, they are open cases in the system. The lady I spoke with transferred me to the corporal in charge of the detectives, who would be, you know, like in charge of that case. Like, so she said that it is with a detective. She didn't give me the detective's name, but she gave me his boss's name, I guess.
Okay.
So I left a message with him. He hasn't gotten back to me as of this recording. I think I'm going to follow up with an email soon. If he happens to hear this, I'm not sure that he'll necessarily want to talk to me.
Probably not with the direction where I feel like we're going to go.
Yeah. You know, but again, like this guy, I don't know who this guy is. I mean, I have his name, but like he wasn't there 40 years ago. You know, whatever happened 40 years ago was not his fault. So I'm hoping that maybe he'll still want to give me a little bit of information. And of course, if I do end up hearing from him or getting in touch with anybody, I will do an update.
I'm surprised they didn't ask you for a FOIA request.
No, I mean, I don't think I've gotten to that point. You know what I mean? Like he might, she was just giving me very general.
Yeah, I guess. Just saying that it was an actual open investigation.
Yeah, exactly.
Somebody has it somewhere.
Right, right. So, you know, we'll see if we get to that point or not. Also, before we get started, I do want to let all of you know who are listening that there is definitely more violence in this case than most of the ones that we cover. And we will be briefly talking about sexual assault. So just heads up there. I mean, there's an attack and it's a central part of this case. And so there's really no getting around it. So I do want to just let you know, because that is not something that's often in our episodes. All right, now that we've gotten all of that out of the way, let's get into the story of Mitchell Owens. Mitchell Dion Owens was born on November 21st, 1978 to Ora Owens. Mitchell was Ora's second child. Her son, Antoine, was about 3 years older, and she had another son, Marte, who was about 3 years younger. Now, I don't really know anything about the identity of the boy's father, just that they were no longer together in 1983, and that he doesn't appear to be a suspect in this, and we'll get into the reasons for that later. Ora grew up mostly in the San Francisco Bay Area with her parents and her 7 siblings. All of the siblings seemingly stayed in the area as they reached adulthood because it mentioned them being around in the weeks after Mitchell's abduction and Ora's attack. And, you know, they were there to support her in this terrible time. Mitchell was called Michael by his family, which...
seems weird.
Yeah, I was like, I read that and it was like, oh yeah, Mitchell, nicknamed Michael. And I was like, wait, what? Like, that's not a thing. But it sounds like it was because his siblings couldn't say Mitchell. Yeah, so it like kind of just stuck. And so actually, and I did notice when I was like typing all this stuff out, I definitely typed out Michael more than once. And I think I changed them all back to Mitchell, but just in case. That might happen. Mitchell's older brother, Antoine, had a speech impediment, and his younger brother, Marte, was only about a year old when Mitchell was abducted. So that kind of explains the whole Michael thing. Ora described her middle son as, quote, a smart little kid. He was apparently the only one who could really understand Antoine when he was speaking. And like she said that he would always translate for him.
That's adorable.
It sounds extremely cute. Like basically, you know, Antoine would say something and she wouldn't get it. And he'd be like, well, he said this, like, didn't you hear him? Like, you know, a little sassy. Mitchell was an adorable, chubby little boy who loved his E.T. doll. It was 1983 after all. And his teddy bear. Ora said that he also loved asking questions, and his aunt agreed that Mitchell was a very inquisitive child. Ora attended a dance with 2 female friends at the Enlisted Men's Club at Moffett Field Naval Air Station in Mountain View, California. There, she later told investigators that she met a man who offered to buy her a drink, which she declined. The rest of the evening seemingly went on as normal, and Ora drove her friends home afterwards. However, she would later say that she felt as though she was being followed on her way home. Like, she had that feeling the whole time, like, to the point where once she got to her apartment building, the person she thought was following her, the car she thought was following her, like, sped away.
So you said this was an enlisted officers club on a naval base?
Yeah.
So maybe I don't know enough about military bases pre-9/11. I'm confused as to how, like, civilians would just get on to a naval base and then go clubbing.
Yeah.
Basically.
I don't know. I mean, I know less about the military than you do, but I would just assume that the answer is pre-9/11. Like, I just think that they had social events like that.
Interesting. So if female civilians got on, then potentially the person that wanted to buy her a drink and potentially followed her home was mm-hmm. also non-military, or could have been non-military.
Could have been, yes.
Yeah. I mean, unless I'm wrong, I don't think that's a thing anymore. I've never heard it. I've been on plenty of military bases, and I've never heard of, like, you know, open social things with non-military or law enforcement.
Yeah, I've been on zero military bases, and I have no idea.
Yeah, listeners, correct us if we're wrong.
Yeah, please, because, yeah, we do not know. The timeline on this is so fuzzy because the police have not really released, like, any information. Anything I'm getting from them is via interviews that they gave to newspapers at the time. We see with news articles, with cases like this, that a lot of times there are contradictions and mistakes and things like that. Like, for instance, her kids' names are spelled like seven different ways in these articles. One says that Mitchell went missing on February 2nd. Like, and so the date of this, Dan's, actually might have even been February 1st. It's just so hard because the attack happened in the middle of the night. So I believe it was the morning of the 3rd.
Okay.
That the attack happened.
It's like sometime after midnight.
Right.
Early morning.
Yeah, hours. It was like 4:30 in the morning, 4:30 in the morning. Okay. On, I believe, the 3rd. A lot of the stories make it sound like it was the evening prior to the attack that the dance was, but it could have been like a full other day before, because one of the police officers gave an interview to a newspaper that said that, you know, she had this experience at this dance and then was kind of freaked out about this guy who followed her. And so the next day she pretty much just stayed home with her kids. So that to me would have been probably the day of the 2nd, and then the attack happened in the middle of the night, which would have been the 3rd. But I think that's why there's like confusion around dates in this story. But in any case, so the next day, she, like I said, she mainly stayed home with her children. She like made them lunch and they just kind of hung out. After she put the kids to bed, Aura stayed up and watched TV. She eventually dozed off, but woke up with a start around 4:30 a.m. when she saw a shadow cross the room. It was basically just one of the situations where she woke up because she just had this sense that somebody was in there with her. And then she saw the shadow. And according to an interview she gave to the Peninsula Times Tribune a year after the attack, quote, "I jumped up and ran into the living room. He grabbed me and forced me back into the bedroom. The only thing I remember him saying was that if I screamed, he'd kill me. I don't know if he was trying to rape me or what, but we were on the bed and I was wrestling with him. I must have fought too hard because he grabbed the telephone cord and wrapped it around my neck. Michael got up. He was a very light sleeper. I screamed for him to go back in his room, and that's all I remember," end quote. Reports differ as to who found Aura that afternoon. Some say it was a neighbor, but another says that it was actually her landlord who was there to collect the rent. Either way, she was found at around 2:30 p.m., and she was still unconscious.
Where was the older boy, Antoine?
Antoine and Marte were in the apartment and unharmed, but so little Mitchell was gone.
How old was Antoine at this point?
7.
So I guess he just thought mom was sleeping?
I guess, yeah. In the articles, it says that he had a speech impediment, which I said before, but I'm wondering, you know, it's 1983. I'm wondering if he isn't actually maybe on the spectrum or something or along maybe, those lines.
Yeah, maybe there's some learning disability or something.
Yeah, that maybe it wasn't so much that he had a speech impediment, but that he wasn't very verbal. So I don't know. I mean, that's just speculation on my part, just kind of reading between the lines of some of these articles and, you know, why he wouldn't have like gone for help or gone to get a neighbor or gone somewhere, you know, when it's 2:30 and his mom is lying on the floor beaten.
Well, we don't know that he or any of the kids went into the room.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. But I mean, you know, we have three kids. Like, I can't imagine.
Sure. But, you know, I mean, maybe they poked their head in and I don't know. Maybe they didn't poke their head in at all.
I don't know. I mean, but you got to think, too, the little one was only a year old, you know?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, he wouldn't know what was going on or if there was even an emergency or anything.
Yeah, but 2:30 and, you know, not eating, presumably maybe Antoine, you know, fed him. I don't know, but that's tough to think about.
Yeah.
Aura ended up regaining consciousness at the hospital, at which point she was told that Mitchell was missing. Now, though she was conscious, Aura was in bad shape. Once she was stable, she was transferred to another hospital to treat her injuries. And it should be noted that her neck, you know, because he strangled her with this telephone cord, he damaged her, you know, vocal cords and her throat so badly that she couldn't speak at first. I mean, it might have been a couple of days before she could even say anything. The second hospital, the one that she was moved to, you know, treat the longer term injuries, remained undisclosed at the time out of fear for her safety. Everyone believed that the attacker either thought she was already dead when he left or that she would die shortly thereafter. So the fear was that he would come after her once he found out that she was alive and could potentially identify him. Police interviewed Aura about what had happened that evening. Though she couldn't remember much, she was able to give a description of her attacker. The very first version of this description that I was able to find came from an interview she did with Leslie Guevara of the San Francisco Examiner that was published on February 16th, 1983, about 2 weeks after the attack and not long after she was released from the hospital. In this article, Aura describes her attacker as, quote, a 6'1" white male in his late 20s to early 30s who weighs 175 to 180 pounds and has brown hair, blue eyes, a mustache, a pot belly, and body odor, end quote. Now, subsequent articles said that he also had tattooed arms. And this is the main reason why Aura's ex wasn't a suspect, because Aura's ex is black and the suspect is white.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
I mean, you know.
Yeah.
And like nobody's thinking this is like a murder for hire type of situation or anything like that. So, I mean, it clearly was not her ex.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, police and everybody, I'm sure, was asking like if she thought she knew the guy, if, you know, she thought she knew who he could be. And, you know, she didn't recognize him. She thought that he could have been a bartender at the dance that she had attended. But police say that no bartenders who were working there that night matched the description. However, it could have been an attendee, perhaps the man who offered to buy Aura a drink. Unfortunately, it's not known how much police actually investigated the people who were at the dance that night.
Well, you also have to think it's 1983, right? So
yeah.
How would they even know who was in attendance? You know, I mean,
yeah.
Nothing was computerized back then, so I'm sure it was
a cover charge
and you walk in.
Yeah, you paid cash and There probably weren't a lot of cameras or even if they were, I'm sure they sucked. Like, you know, it's always valuable to talk to people.
Oh, for sure.
And I just don't know that they did.
I mean, they might have.
They might have.
Not something they're going to readily release, though.
Sure. Yeah. No. 40 years. I mean, don't want to give anything away. It's not known if the other two children actually slept through the attack and perhaps weren't seen by the assailant, or if they did wake up at some point. We just know that Mitchell is the only one whom Aura saw. And I find it very interesting that this man took Mitchell, which, I mean, is what we have to assume happened.
Sure.
Because let's say that he didn't know that there were two other children in the apartment. Maybe he thought he was taking the only living witness. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what if the other children did wake up? Marte was a baby, so it would have been safe to assume that he wouldn't be able to say anything. But what about Antoine? I mean, he was 7, and yes, he had this like speech impediment or, you know, whatever was going on, but would the attacker have realized that?
I mean, I doubt it unless he spoke to him.
Right.
Unless Antoine spoke or said something.
Yeah. If that was the case, though, I mean, either way, like, why not take him as well? But more importantly, why take Mitchell at all? We know that this guy is capable of not only extreme violence, but also murder. He absolutely tried to kill Aura and likely thought that he had. So why not just kill Mitchell as well? It was much more dangerous to take him. A white man in his mid-20s with a black toddler is going to stand out.
I mean, maybe he just couldn't bring himself to kill a kid.
I mean, maybe, but he doesn't seem like he has a very high moral compass at this point. I mean, he broke into this woman's home, saw her child, knew that he was there, and still proceeded to rape and beat and strangle his mother.
Yeah, I mean, look, you're not getting any arguments from me on how bad of a person he is.
Yeah.
But yeah, I maybe that was his threshold, is, you know, not killing kids. I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah, so this is what we have. A young mother who was raped and beaten nearly to death, and a 4-year-old who was abducted in the middle of the night. Seems like a pretty huge story, but it was not.
And you said she was discovered around 2:30. So what, that's like 10 hours later?
Yeah.
10 hours is a long time.
It's a big head start.
Yeah.
Immediately after the abduction, a few newspaper articles were written and the story was featured on local news, like once, but the whole thing quickly disappeared from the headlines. So, all right, not a huge story, but, you know, surely the investigation was handled well. They had a description. They had a white man with a black child. There are actual clues to go on, which, more clues than we see in a lot of these cases. And more solid proof that this child is in imminent danger than we have in a lot of these cases. This should have been the investigation. Like, they should have been going like full force on this. But as you already know from my intro, they did not.
So I'm anxious to hear if there's any reasoning or thought process behind them classifying Mitchell initially as a runaway.
Well, it was a black family in 1983.
Sure.
So there's that. But yeah. No, in terms of classifying him as a runaway, the police have never publicly, from what I could see, like, they've never publicly said that. That came from Aura. That is what she said they told her at the beginning. So because of that, we don't have anything where they're like giving their reasoning behind it.
Okay. So she said that they told her he probably ran away.
Yeah.
Okay. So we don't know whether that's how they handled the investigation or the...
You've got to think, too, that even at this point in 1983, even when it was a child, a lot of times they were still waiting like that 24 hours. Also, by the police's own admission, in the first year of the investigation, they only interviewed about 40 people.
Why?
Black family, 1983. I mean, honestly, I know, you know, people are going to get annoyed, but like, I cannot think of another reason. They uncovered 0 leads. And listen, I don't know exact numbers, but I would have to believe that if you added up the people at the dance and the people in the apartment building where Aura and her boys lived, that would probably equal more than 40 people.
Yeah.
Then, if you add people who live on her street, I can only imagine how not 40 that number is.
So we don't even know if they did any canvassing of the neighborhood, talked to neighbors.
No.
Where is this again?
Menlo Park, California. It's near Palo Alto.
Okay, so Menlo Park might be small, but it's not like it's in the middle of nowhere.
No, I mean, this is, well, now it's Silicon Valley. Like, now it's an incredibly wealthy area. It wasn't in 1983, but yeah, it wasn't like, you know, some podunk town in the middle of nowhere either.
So even if the local PD was small,
yeah,
there are resources available.
Oh yeah, readily available, for sure. And this is, of course, completely anecdotal, but like, I've seen comments from people when I was researching this that are like, wait, what? I grew up in Menlo Park. Like, I lived there when this happened. I have no idea that this was ever a thing. But that's not to say that they did nothing. After the abduction, all seven of Aura's siblings joined police and a California Highway Patrol helicopter crew on a 6-hour search where they scoured the neighborhood and nearby marshlands.
When was this?
This was like a couple days after. I think this was like the 3 days like after, you know, when they started the investigation.
I mean, so at that point, they're looking for a body. Like,
they haven't even
gone down the avenue of he might be alive and this might be an abduction. They're just like, he's probably dead. So let's go look for a body.
Yeah. Or let's go look for this 4-year-old who ran away and is hiding somewhere.
Right. Because he'll be alive 3 to 4 days later.
Yeah, I don't know. About a week after the abduction, police also searched the mudflats near the Dumbarton Bridge. So why there specifically? A February 10th article from the San Francisco Examiner said that police were working on a, quote, tip from an unnamed informant, end quote. 6 days later, though, the same paper named the informant. Cupertino psychic, Kathleen Ray. We know that police loved using psychics in the 80s, but this is what they were doing in the first week of the investigation.
Right. Not in a window where they should be already grasping at straws.
Right.
Like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah. Like, so instead of canvassing the neighborhood, instead of like talking to the people.
Basic police work.
Yeah. They're going on tips from psychics in the first week of the investigation. And like the psychic thing, you know, again, if we're talking months down the road, everything else is dried up.
Give it a try.
It's like, who gives a shit? You're not going to hurt anything.
It's dumb, but it's not going to hurt. Right. It's not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like the first week, those are not where you should be putting your resources.
Right.
Those are the only two police searches that I could find any mention of. The initial search that the six siblings went on. There was no mention of like how many other people were on that search. And then this like 2-hour search of the mudflats because the psychic told them to go there. And that's it.
So just playing devil's advocate here, do you think, I mean, obviously this is shitty police work, but do you think it's really shitty police work or just shitty reporting?
Both. For sure.
Okay.
Mainly shitty police work, but also shitty reporting. I mean, honestly, because, you know, that is the big thing, is that the media largely ignored this case. And, you know, they didn't put a lot of effort into digging, into finding out what was going on with the investigation.
Or even truthful fact-finding, because you said that there were articles that had different dates as far as when the attack occurred versus
yeah,
when she was out at the bar. So, like, they weren't really putting a whole lot of effort into even getting a solid timeline down. The media.
No.
And one would assume that the police at least had that from Aura's statements.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm sure the police had a better timeline, but, you know, again, they didn't talk to the media. And, you know, we talked about this in the Alexis Patterson case a lot, where a lot of times the police are the ones who really inform what cases get covered and how much they get covered, right? If they are making themselves available to reporters, if they are giving reporters information and basically telling reporters that this is important, this is something that needs to be covered, then it gets covered generally. And that is not what we were seeing here. Yes, they spoke to reporters. I have some quotes from some investigators here and there, but they did not go out of their way to get this case covered and to reach out to the public.
Which doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I mean, I understand not tipping your hand and letting information out that might disrupt a potential conviction down the line, but getting the description out of the attacker, there's no world in which that would potentially screw up a conviction later.
Right.
Especially if you're talking about the thought that he may have Mitchell.
Yeah, exactly. And so I will say that one of the articles, the one that was written about 2 weeks after the incident, did include a sketch of the suspect based on Aura's description.
Right, but that's 2 weeks later. Okay, face value, 1983, I'm a cop, I get this case. I don't understand why you wouldn't put that description out right away to start the neighborhood.
Right, and I don't know that they didn't necessarily, because I do know that it was covered on the local TV news. I would think that the sketch and the description would have been part of that report. Unfortunately, that's not something that's available now. I am fairly certain there were other newspaper articles that I also just couldn't get to. So I don't want to say that that article 2 weeks after the attack was the first and only time that that sketch was released. But what I will say is that the police really were not giving. They were not just actively out there giving information. All of the quotes that I do have really seems like, okay, the reporter went to the hospital, they happened to run into an officer, and the officer like gave him a quote kind of thing.
Yeah.
They weren't holding press conferences or things of that nature. In addition to the bartender slash man who offered to buy her drink at, you know, the naval base, another interesting suspect emerged. Now, this wasn't in any of the early stories that I found, but apparently the evening of the attack, so like before she, you know, dozed off watching TV, Aura received a knock on the door. And I couldn't find the original article that she got this from because the link is dead now and I just couldn't find it anywhere else. But according to the Charlie Project, a uniformed police officer came to Aura's apartment and asked her about a purse she had reported stolen about a month before. The problem is, when they found this out, Menlo Park police apparently checked into it, but they have no record of any of their officers stopping by Aura's home on that date. So we have 1 6-hour search, a 2-hour search based on a psychic's tip, about 40 interviews, and maybe a police officer who visited the home the night of the attack, or maybe somebody impersonating a police officer who visited the home on the night of the attack. Like, who knows?
Right.
Other than this apparent like, oh yeah, no, we never sent anybody out that night. I don't know anything else about that. About whether or not they looked into it, like what the fuck is going on there. And so that is the beginning and the ending of what I know about the effort that was put into finding a brutal rapist, attempted murderer, and child abductor.
That concerns me because, okay, if we are to believe that the person that knocked on her door was impersonating a police officer and that that was also the same person who committed this violent act, that's a lot of forethought. That's a lot of planning.
Right.
And that to me is not something spontaneous, which means this is probably somebody who would have either had done this before or would do it again.
Yeah. And somebody who had been watching her.
Right.
You know?
And if this is a random person who does not know her, which we would assume she would have recognized this person if she did know her, then that sounds to me like the beginnings of a serial rapist.
Well, honestly, as soon as I read about that, when I do the research, I try to do it as chronologically as possible.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd already read about the attack itself. And then, you know, I saw that this, you know, it was later revealed that this police officer, in quotes, had come to her door. I immediately thought Golden State Killer.
Right.
Because he was operating in that area. He was a former police officer.
Right.
Before he started murdering people, he was raping them. You know, he was known to not give a shit if kids were around.
Mm-hmm.
And like, so I actually like, I didn't go deep into a rabbit hole, but I kind of did look at it. And this 1983 was actually one of the years that he like took a break. Like he doesn't have any known cases around this time. I want to say from like 1981 to like 1986, he, like there's not really much known. And then he pops back up in Southern California, but a lot of his crimes were up in this like Northern California area. So I did kind of think about that a little bit. I don't think so. I mean, again, if the tattoo part of it is correct, like then that doesn't fit for sure.
Sure.
But like, I don't know. It creeped me out. Like it did give me East Area Rapist
right
vibes.
Which makes me wonder whether the police looked into that as, you know, did they look into other attacks or attempted attacks, attempted rapes, anything that would kind of overlap or match what happened here?
Yeah.
To kind of circle back to maybe this was not a one-off attack.
But here's what terrifies me. And this is why I really want to do more digging into this case, because this police officer or person impersonating a police officer talked to her about a report that she made about a stolen purse. So
right.
If this is just some random fucking guy,
so wait,
how would he know about the purse? And there was, and that wasn't followed up with, but Aura had never reported a purse stolen.
Right.
So if
shit.
Like,
so it, okay.
So then
that wouldn't necessarily be something that would be public knowledge. It's not like you can go and, especially in 1983, you couldn't like go look at police reports.
Right. And that's not something that somebody's going to put in the police blotter in the newspaper. And even if they do, they're not going to have her name or whatever.
Right.
So like,
shit.
Right. So then that's when we get the fucking tinfoil hats on. And you go, what if this was a cop?
Yeah.
What if they're covering for him? And what if that's why this investigation was so shitty?
Yeah.
Because they were covering for somebody. See, now this corporal's never going to fucking talk to me.
No, you're absolutely right. Also, who has a corporal that's in charge of detectives? It seems weird.
I don't know. The 40 interviews, you know, et cetera, like that, the two searches, that's what we've got. The other interesting thing about that I will say is that, yes, okay, we have two separate crimes here that are obviously connected. They were done in tandem. I don't know if it's a sign of the times, the fact that this brutal rapist and attempted murderer is presumably walking around free was kind of ignored because rape was like barely a crime at this point in history. And at that point, it is more important that Mitchell is missing because as horrible as the attack was, it had already happened. It was done. Mitchell missing is like an active, ongoing danger. But it's just so strange the way police spoke about this and the way the media covered it. They covered it just almost like a standard missing child case, not there's also this violent criminal who was out there. And I just found that to be so odd. It was like, oh yeah, like this kid's missing, which is great. Like that's what the message we need to be getting out there. But like also this violent criminal is potentially out there harming this child and is potentially out there harming other women. But like nobody seemed to be worried about that.
Do you think it was just because of the era in which it happened? So
I think that's a lot of it. I really do. I mean, conspiracy theories aside, I do think that a lot of that is because it was 1983.
Yeah. And just to give my contextual understanding of media and how it was late 70s, early 80s, and how crazy crime was back then.
Right.
Because, yeah, believe it or not, everybody talks about how bad crime is now.
It's nothing.
It's nothing compared to the way it was back then.
Right.
So, like, my dad, law enforcement, back in Pittsburgh, he used to tell me these stories about, and he told me this one in particular about how there was a known brothel, essentially, in downtown Pittsburgh that was connected to the mafia, and a bomb went off in the brothel, shooting sex workers out of the building into the streets of downtown Pittsburgh. And it was a blip on the evening news, because that sort of thing literally happened all the time.
Yeah.
Because that was just what was going on then. So it was like mentioned, but it wasn't like something like that happening now. It seems like, holy shit, that's like movie stuff. That's not something that actually happened, but it did. That was just what was going on back then.
Well, yeah, and you got to think, too, we're talking about California, and at that time, I mean, more in the 70s than the early 80s, but it's like every fifth man was a serial killer.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, especially in California.
Exactly. It's like, shit. I mean, I don't know. So I do think a lot of it is the time. But yeah, if you want
to... As far as the reporting goes. But
and the way it was talked about.
Right.
Not only by the reporters, but by police as well.
How casual.
Yeah.
And nonchalant it was.
Yeah.
But the investigation should have probably been handled better.
I mean, obviously, but yeah, it's so strange. I mean, all right, so it was 1983, so there were obviously no Amber Alerts or social media that police could have used to help alert the public that there was an abducted boy. Not that they necessarily would have, even if they did have those tools. So this is where the whole, like, runaway thing comes from, and where, like, this is, we're going to talk more about the attitudes at the time. In a 1986 interview with Ebony Magazine, Ora had some scathing words for the Menlo Park police, saying, quote, it was like they didn't care. She says that they didn't enter Mitchell into NCIC, which is the FBI's National Crime Information Center, until more than a year after his disappearance. This is certainly negligent, but it should be pointed out that at the time of Mitchell's abduction, this was not a requirement for missing persons cases. It was shortly thereafter that a law was enacted that requires the immediate entry as soon as a missing person is reported. So, okay, you can kind of get it, like, there wasn't a law, so why should I actually...
Well, I think, and I'm not... a historian on NCIC, but it was relatively new, I think.
Oh, yeah.
So,
for sure.
Like, I don't think a lot of law enforcement agencies were using it back then.
Yeah, and I think that is the case.
Nor did they see the value in it, because, again, it's 1983. Like, a lot of cops were still using typewriters, and there weren't a lot of computers.
Oh, yeah, no, for sure. I mean, much later than that, but... The big problem with this, I mean, not only that he didn't get entered for a year, but the problem is that according to Ora, investigators had told her that they had entered him in.
Ah, okay.
And they hadn't.
Okay, so that's different.
That's a big red flag right there. Now, keep in mind, too, that Ora's injuries were so severe that she had to spend about 2 weeks in the hospital recovering. You know, I mentioned earlier she, like, couldn't really speak. She had muscle and nerve damage as well from the beating. And so she's left-handed. In an interview with her that I read a year after the attack, she still couldn't lift more than, like, 5 pounds with her left arm. Like, it was just... severely damaged. So she had a lot of physical injuries from this. So by the time she was released from the hospital, the two searches that I had talked about before had already been completed. And it basically seemed as though police were already finished actively investigating this case. She says that they didn't offer her any support or resources. She didn't even know that there were agencies out there that helped find missing people until a year later. And not only that, but Aura says that police did so little because they told her that her 4-year-old baby child was a runaway. She said that the officer in charge told her, quote, "I didn't matter and that I was poor, black, and on welfare, and it would be one less mouth to feed," end quote.
Jesus.
So that's what she was dealing with. This is obviously disgusting and fuck that cop and fuck everyone like him forever. But even though this is what she was up against when she is released from the hospital, barely escaping with her life and her son is gone, she's a mom. And so she still felt guilty because she didn't think that she had done enough to find her son. She told reporters, quote, "I didn't know where to go, and I don't feel like enough was done then. I wasn't smart enough or qualified enough to get enough done," end quote. Which is just absolutely heartbreaking. Because yes, I mean, you're the mom, like you want to be out there doing things. You want to be the one finding your son. But like the people in charge need to be doing their jobs. You know, like there are people whose literal job it is to go find your son, to find this man who did this to you. And they were not. She was living with this guilt. But as time went on, Aura was able to connect with people who could help her, such as the Vanished Children's Alliance, the Missing Children's Project out of Oakland, and eventually the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, which was formed after Mitchell's abduction.
Right.
About 15 months after his abduction, the Kevin Collins Committee, which was named for a little boy who went missing in San Francisco not long after Mitchell, helped publicize Mitchell's case and organized another search for him. And I'm going to have to do an episode on this because, like, Kevin Collins also just vanished and his family really turned their tragedy. Very similar to the Morgan Nick Foundation, mm-hmm. where they like use this as an opportunity to shine light. Oh, and the Gabby Petito Foundation, like
right.
to shine light on these cases that were ignored. They organized the search for them. They held a press conference 15 months after Mitchell's disappearance. And at this press conference, they were joined by Menlo Park Police Lieutenant Ken Sorensen, Aura, and Melvie Brown of the Missing Children's Project. But something alarming happened to Aura that day. Before the press conference, she went home to pick up some extra flyers. But when she arrived at her apartment, the door was ajar. She panicked and rushed back to the community center, which is where they were holding the press conference, and she told Lieutenant Sorensen about this. He dispatched officers to her apartment to check it out and to kind of keep an eye on it. I think he stationed an officer there for a time. They never saw anything. They have no idea, you know, if it had to do with anything or if it was just some random
sure
whatever. But scary, obviously traumatic for her, you know, for somebody who had just been through this horrible event 15 months prior. Unfortunately, that isn't the only unsettling incident that happened to Aura in the years after her attack and her son's abduction. Again, according to the Charlie Project, for years after, Aura received telephone calls from an unidentified male who threatened to abduct her other sons. I couldn't find any more information on that either. Obviously, police never figured out who was responsible or if it was even actually related to Mitchell's abduction or just a terrible prank, which we do also hear about in cases like this sometimes. As the years went on, Aura stayed involved in missing persons organizations. In 2000, she joined other parents of missing children to fight for state testing of DNA in hopes of identifying unidentified remains. So basically, you know, we have like the DOE network, we have NamUs, you know, we have all these things, these tools now where, you know, we can match DNA samples that are given, they're put in a database and we can match them with unidentified remains. But that is a fairly new tool that we have in these investigations. And so Aura was really at the forefront fighting for this because her fear at that point was, what if my baby is
one of the unidentified
yeah.
remains
and he's there
yeah,
and nobody knows and I don't know.
Yeah.
So Aura did submit her DNA. So when you look on NamUs, like, there is DNA available in this case. Unfortunately, what I do not know, and what I really was hoping to find out from Menlo Park, is what, if any, evidence was kept from Aura's assault. I've got to assume that they did a rape kit at the hospital.
Right, but again, 1983,
yeah.
DNA testing wasn't really a thing.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't a thing yet, but
I don't know what level the rape kit would have.
Right, but it had anything, I mean, they could, if the samples are still there, they could be tested now.
Yeah.
The problem is, the case wasn't taken seriously 40 years ago, and it has been 40 years. So what is left? What condition is it in? Is there anything?
How long do they keep evidence in cases like that?
Right. I mean, the case is still open. So I would hope that...
That doesn't mean anything.
They would still have the evidence. But yeah, no, I don't know. And so, like, that's what I want to know. That is my big thing. Like, yes, it's great that Aura's DNA is out there. So in case Mitchell's remains are found, we could potentially identify him. But I want to know about the attacker. I want to know about the man who took Mitchell. I want to know if we have any physical evidence that can be tested, that if there's any way that we can use what was taken 40 years ago in order to find out who did this. Because this attack was so brutal, and it is obviously tied to the abduction, the physical evidence, at least at one point, did exist, which is so much more than we have in most of the cases that we've covered. I mean, we've covered almost zero cases with physical evidence. So the fact that there's even the potential for it in this case could put us leaps and bounds ahead of so many others. So I know that I've been hard on the Menlo Park Police Department in this episode, and I don't feel bad about that at all.
Right, but you were hard on the Menlo Park Police Department of 40 years ago.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
The police officers who are there today are not the ones who were there 40 years ago.
Might be the kids of
the I mean,
ones
maybe.
That were there 40 maybe. Years ago.
But the ones who are there now are not responsible for botching this investigation then.
Right.
If every conspiracy theory is true and there was even a cover-up, it's not these people.
Right.
Who did it.
Yeah. So let go of the bullshit tradition of upholding what previous cops did and fucking dig in.
Yeah, I mean,
dig into it, look into the case. Like you said, if there's still existing evidence, test it. If there's anything out there that indicates that a cop was actually responsible for it, like, expose it. Get it out there. Clear the Menlo Park police of today.
Yeah, like you were saying, like, the officers who are there now realize that even after so much time, there are still investigative avenues that can be explored, and that there are people out there who still care about what happened to Aura and Mitchell Owens and who want to find answers for her. Mitchell Owens has been missing from Menlo Park, California since February 3, 1983. Mitchell is a black male with brown hair and brown eyes. His right eyelid droops and he has a scar on his nose and a surgical scar on his left rib area. At the time of his abduction, he was about 3 feet tall and weighed around 40 pounds. Mitchell was 4 years old when he went missing. He would be 43 today. If you have any information regarding the disappearance of Mitchell Owens, please contact the Menlo Park Police Department at 650-330-6300. Tips can also be called in to the Department of Public Safety at 617-754-3208 or 3209. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
and be sure to follow us on social. And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I'm not exactly a tech genius, but I knew one thing for sure. If I wanted my small business to crush it, I needed a website that worked like a pro, and I needed it yesterday. Lucky for me, Bluehost made it ridiculously easy. With their AI design tools, building my website was a walk in the park. I could customize, optimize, and monetize everything exactly how I wanted. In just a few minutes, I had a secure site up and running. I couldn't believe how straightforward it was. And getting found online? Bluehost helped me with that, too. I perfected my keywords and meta descriptions with their search engine tools. The AI even gave me suggestions to improve my pages. Now I can sit back, relax, and focus on my customers, while my website continues to rank higher and higher on Google. With their 30-day money-back guarantee, I wasn't worried about taking the plunge. And now I'm so glad I did. Head over to Bluehost.com and build something special today.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains May 2nd through the 12th. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.